So this is a third part of our community seminars, and the first week we went over how to help your kids have good grades, and then last week we talked about how to help your kids wait until marriage, and this week we're looking at developing a meaningful faith in kids. You guys were all here before, so I won't spend a whole lot of time introducing myself, but again, my name is Steve Nelson, and that's my family up there. We have 8 kids, 4 boys, 4 girls. And I've been a pastor for about 15 years and spent a little bit of time teaching. And just have a heart for kids and really want to make a difference in the community. I feel like one of the best ways we can make a difference is to make sure that we're doing a good job with our own kids. And as we change families, then it starts to change society. Typically, our seminars, we've been trying to be somewhat non-religious just because we wanted to take an opportunity to be able to invite teachers and students and military and people that might be offended or might not be able to promote these if we had them as religious seminars. And so we've tried to be somewhat non-religious. Obviously, if we're talking about developing a meaningful faith in kids, it's going to be a little bit religious, but I'm still going to try to be kind of generic, and I don't think anybody should be too offended from here, so I think we'll be just fine. But the first thing we need to do is to discover the truth about God and then help your kids find that truth. So it seems like in today's day and age, for whatever reason, it's popular to, as a parenting technique, to let your kids kind of discover their own truth or to not teach religion to your kids, almost like it's presumptuous or something to teach religion to your kids because, you know, well, who are you to teach them? And if you just let them have time, then as they get older, they'll be able to figure out what religion they want. And personally, I think that's really foolish, not to be too opinionated. But I think it implies one of two things. Either you don't know, you don't know what the true path is or the true way, or you don't have really any confidence in what you believe. And in that case, it kind of makes sense because your beliefs are kind of fuzzy and you don't want to pass on kind of fuzzy beliefs to your kids. And so I could kind of see it in that sense, but then it seems like it would be better to clarify your own beliefs to help find the truth and then pass that on than to just not pass it on at all. So obviously, if you don't know what you believe, then it is hard to pass it on. But it's something that's important. It's not like, you know, trying to decide, do you want paper or plastic at the grocery store, or do you want your coffee black or with cream and sugar? You know, it's not just something that's up to our own preference and if we think something's a good idea or not. It's a matter of truth, and it's a matter of finding that truth and then helping our kids learn that truth. We don't do this with anything else that we believe is important. We don't say, you know, well, mathematics is really important, but it's really best if your kids discover that on their own. And so we're just going to start them off, not teach them anything, and hope that they discover these different mathematical theorems on their own. And, you know, that just doesn't make sense. If we know something's true, then we want to pass it on to our kids. And so don't hesitate at all to teach truth to your kids. Letting them choose their own path or their own religion could also imply that, well, it doesn't matter. One religion is no different from another. One belief system is pretty much the same as another. And that comes from kind of an Eastern philosophy, Eastern religion idea of all religions are the same, all paths lead to the same God, or all paths lead to heaven, which I suppose some people might view as a valid religious system, but as we think through it, as we look at different possibilities, to me it doesn't make a lot of sense. For example, if we just think about eternal life, what happens after you die? Well, those Eastern religions might say, well, you come back as a different person, or maybe even come back as an animal, depending on how you lived your life, might depend on how you come back. Okay, so that's one belief system. In Christianity, in the Western world, we would tend to believe, well, there's an afterlife, there's a heaven and a hell, and what you do here on the earth, or maybe what you believe, can affect that afterlife. Well, that's a very different belief system. I talked to one guy at the park one day that he said that what he believed was, when you died, just that was it. Just you just die and that's the end. You know, there is no afterlife. So those are three very different thoughts on faith. Three very different thoughts on eternity. And we can't just say, you know, well, which one do you prefer? What do you like? You know, when you get old enough, you can pick which one you think is the best. That doesn't make any sense. What it comes down to is, well, which one's true? Or is there something else that's true? You know, that's what it comes down to. Is there a truth? Can we discover that truth? How can we find that truth? What's the source of our truth? We need to be able to answer those questions. And so if we're just letting our kids choose their own path, I think it implies those two things. Either you just don't know what the right path is, or it doesn't matter to you, or you don't think that it matters. And so for us as parents, we need to make sure that we have a solid grasp of the truth. If we don't know clearly what truth is, if we don't have something that we look at it and it's worth teaching to our kids, then there's something that needs to change in our own lives. We need to understand real clearly what the truth is so that we can pass it on to our kids. The next thing that I want to talk about in terms of passing on a faith to our kids is the importance of them understanding that there's a creator. And this is the part my wife's going to hate, but she doesn't like it when you talk about creation and get too heady and stuff like that. And I'm not a particularly super smart person or anything, and so I like to keep things simple, and I'll keep this pretty simple. But this is really critical, because if God didn't create us, if we just evolved, if everything happened just naturally, that implies certain things. If we just came to being, if we went from being just minerals and gases and dirt and stuff, and somehow those mixed together, and then there were changes and changes and changes and changes, we ended up being here. Well, what's that imply about an afterlife? Well, there probably isn't one, because we're just natural. We're not supernatural. We're just part of nature. We're not apart from nature. We're not different at all. And so why would we believe that we would go to heaven, or that there would be any form of, you know, judgment or reincarnation or anything? Why would you be any different than a rock? Because basically that's what we would have come from if that would be the case. And so it's really important that we teach our kids that there's a creator, because if we don't do that, then the implication is religion really doesn't matter. And if you think through this, you think about how important this is, and then we think about, where are kids going to learn this? Now, if we look at our school system and look at what gets taught in school, are they going to learn about a creator in school? No. I mean, I grew up a long time ago when, you know, the schools were even more conservative than they are now, and I didn't hear anything about any evidence for there being a creator until I was in college and I went to a debate. And if I hadn't gone to that, you know, who knows when I would have heard. And so in science, they're going to present a case, and there's another side of that case. And if you don't do something about that, or if your church doesn't do something about that, then your kids just really have very little hope of believing anything different than what they've been taught. There's a Proverbs that says that he who's first to present his case seems right, until someone else comes forward and question him. You know, what you're taught initially is what you think, oh yeah, that makes sense. Unless somebody else comes along and says, well, you know, look at this other case. And so we need to have some kind of basis to help our kids understand that there's a creator, and hopefully some of the stuff we cover tonight real briefly will help us to understand that. We need to understand there's two basic beliefs about where everything came from. The first is that everything must have occurred naturally. And so that's the scientific viewpoint. And science is wonderful, and this is important for science to act this way. Science kind of needs to behave in this manner where it ignores the possibility of supernatural. So If you don't do that, what happens is, you know, we think about, well, why does the earth revolve? Say, well, God made it do that. Why do we need oxygen? Well, God made us do that. Why does your car rust? Well, God must be punishing us. Or, you know, we can just kind of explain away everything supernaturally. And so when we do that, it doesn't really lead to scientific discovery very well. But if we say, well, the universe and our world tends to operate on scientific laws, then we can discover things and we can look at the rust and say, okay, there's probably a natural explanation for this. And then you test it with water and different metals and oxygen, and you realize, okay, certain materials are corrosive and certain things add to that corrosiveness. And we learn and we discover because we don't assume that everything's supernatural. So that kind of makes sense. But the problem is if there's anything that occurs supernaturally, we cannot discover it scientifically. Because it's outside of the box. It's just, that is not the way that science works. Science is the study of the natural. And so if anything comes outside of that, then we're just stuck and we are not going to find it scientifically. So the second view is that there may have been supernatural involvement in the creation. Now, I have very specific thoughts about this. I have very specific thoughts about how long that took and how things were created and things like that. But for tonight, we're just going to go very basic. Okay, so for number two, the thought would be, well, God created things. Or at the very least, God created things in some form and then maybe allowed things to evolve and change, or maybe even allowed things to evolve and change and helped it along at different points. That would be a viewpoint. But it's critical to understand that either there was supernatural involvement at some level or there wasn't. Now, if there was supernatural involvement at some level, and science just kind of puts on its blinders and says, no, that cannot be, it must be natural, then what's going to happen where that natural and supernatural bump up against each other? Things are going to get kind of weird, because science is going to have a good explanation. And for whatever reason, it seems like science is not very comfortable just saying, we don't know. And so if it gets to a tough point in the road, instead of saying, we don't know, they'll say, well, this is the best explanation we can come up with. And so whatever their explanation is, whatever the kind of ruling theory is, becomes almost the law, almost just truth, and it's accepted, even though you might step back and look at it and be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Because they can't go to the supernatural level. So, what do we do with that? How do we help our kids understand this? And so I want to go through five different points related to creation, just because you've got to be able to help your kids with this. If you don't do this, no one else is going to. And I've been a science teacher. I've sat there in class and taught about the Big Bang and explained it, and that's what I had to do. And I would try to, you know, get feedback from my kids and, you know, so what do you guys think? Do you think that makes sense? And try to talk through it, and it's hard to walk that line, even though I had very specific beliefs that were different. Hope, our 15-year-old, was in class just a couple weeks ago, and they were covering evolution. And I think they had already covered most of it, and at one point Hope said to the teacher, you know, I'm kind of uncomfortable with this. I don't think this makes sense. And the teacher was like, Hope, that's why I ask questions in class. That's your opportunity to speak up. And I think what he was saying was, yeah, this doesn't make sense to me either, but I can't say it. I need you to say it. And so it's just kind of in the system that we get taught this evolutionary scientific viewpoint, even though a lot of people may not believe it, and at least don't believe it fully. And I think most people probably think, well, there had to be some help from God. God had to be involved in this process. So these are going to be 5 points that I think will be pretty easy for you to grasp. There might be one that's a little bit weird. To me, this one's a really cool argument. It's called the watchmaker. And it's a pretty simple argument. The guy that came up with it, his name was William Paley, and it was in 1802. And I took what he wrote, and I just trying to put it in modern English. So this is kind of a quote from him, but edited so that it was a little bit smoother. As in crossing a field, suppose I struck my foot against a stone and someone asked me where I thought the stone had come from. I might answer that, as far as I could tell, it had been there forever. It would not be easy to prove me wrong, but suppose I'd found a watch upon the ground and someone should ask me how the watch happened to be there. I would never think of the answer that I had previously given, that the watch had always been there. There must have existed at some time and at some place or another a craftsman or several craftsmen who made the watch for the purpose of keeping time, who engineered its construction and designed its use. Every indication of inventive skill, every expression of design which existed in the watch exists in nature, with nature exhibiting an even greater level of complexity than the watch, and that in a degree which exceeds all mathematical probability. So real simply, what he's saying, you're walking along the road, you see a rock, you pick it up, and you think, well, this looks like part of nature. You're walking along the road, you see a watch, and you pick it up, and you say, there must have been a watchmaker. This is not natural, this is not normal. And we just intuitively know that. Basically, what he's saying is, okay, well, if you can do that, then what if you looked at a butterfly, which is way more complicated than a watch? Well, by the same reason, we should be able to look at it and say, you know what? There is just no way this thing came about naturally. And so this argument is something that's it's very simple. You could even explain this to your kids tonight before bed, and they would be like, yeah, that makes sense, because it's just so basic. Now, if you were arguing with an atheist over this or something, they have heard this argument before, and they would have thoughts, and they would have their explanations on why they don't like it. But personally, I think it's sound. It's a very sound argument, and it's the way that the world is created. It's just, it's obvious that there must be a creator. You may have heard this quote before. It's by a guy named Fred Hoyle. He said, the chance that, this is your next blank too, Hoyle's Junkyard, the chance that higher life forms might have emerged in this way, talking about evolution, is comparable to the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. Again, this is kind of a common sense reasoning. He's a mathematician, so he's looking at how difficult it would be for things to happen naturally. So basically, he's saying, if you could have a bolt and a nut, and it's sitting in the junkyard, and a tornado comes through, and somehow it just twists that just right so the bolt and nut are put together. And you might think of that and be like, okay, it's probably not going to happen, but maybe. Okay, so now what if two bolts and nuts could come together? I think, probably not. But what if there were two pieces of material and the bolts and nuts worked together to bolt those two pieces of material together? No, that's not going to happen. And then you say, okay, well, what if just everything in the junkyard was like that and just everything just by chance came together and got bolted together and everything worked so that you had a functioning airplane? Well, at some point we look at that and say, just common sense, no. That is just absolutely impossible. Now, the problem is with evolution is what they'll say is, well, you know, we have an infinite amount of time to work with. And so even if you had the smallest possible percentage chance that something would happen, it will happen. So given, you know, enough billions of galaxies and billions of planets and billions of opportunities and billions of junkyards and billions of tornadoes, then eventually, yeah, it's going to form an airplane. And we still say, no, that's not going to happen. And just common sense, we can look at that and say, just statistically, it's impossible. It just cannot happen. And again, I think this is an illustration that would be very easy for kids to understand. He put it in another way, which I kind of like. He said he compared the chance of obtaining even a single functioning protein by chance combination of amino acids, to a solar system full of blind men solving Rubik's Cube at the exact same time. And so our solar system is, you know, the sun and the planets. And so he's saying, if you had a blind guy working on a Rubik's Cube, and when I looked up on the web today, they do have Rubik's Cubes in Braille. But I think he's talking about a Rubik's Cube without the Braille. okay? So this is just a random Rubik's Cube, and a blind guy's working on it. Well, there's some chance eventually he'll accidentally solve it. Okay, but what if you had a whole planet full of blind guys working on Rubik's Cubes? Or you took all those blind guys and you filled up, you know, not just the Earth, but the Earth full of blind guys all the way out till the sun, all the way out to the furthest planet, and you had all these blind guys. This is probably not a politically correct illustration, so glad there's no blind guys here tonight. Okay, so, and you imagine that, and there's one guy sitting there working, and suddenly he's like, I got it. And right at the exact same time that he says that, all the other solar system full of blind guys say, I got it, everybody at once. What are the odds of that happening? It just can't. It just cannot happen. And so that gives us an idea of the numbers. And here are the numbers he uses. The odds of life evolving are about 1 in 10 to the 40,000s, which, if you remember from math, it's a 1 with 40,000 zeros behind it. Now, the evolutionists would say, well, it's not really random because it's natural selection, to which I'd say, no, it's not, because when we're talking about the formation of life, it's not natural selection, it's just life. It's just, there's no natural selection between rocks or between non-living things. It's just completely random, at least up until that first life form is formed. So, of course, that number means absolutely nothing to us. This might help. There are only 10 to the 80 atoms in the known universe. So, thankfully, I'm brushed up on my planets and universes and stuff from teaching science. The universe is everything. It's all of space. And so, supposedly, there are billions of galaxies, each galaxy containing billions of stars, which could potentially be their own little solar system. And so this is just this huge amount of space. And if you could number all the atoms in that huge amount of space, it would be a 1 with 80 zeros behind it, would be an estimate. And then you could paint one of them red and hide it somewhere in the whole universe. Could be, you know, 100 light years away. And then you said, okay, pick one. And you could somehow pick one atom. What are the odds that you get that one that was painted red? Well, you're just not going to do it. It's impossible. And that number of atoms is small compared to the number that he calculated for evolution. And I don't even know how you can come up with a number for evolution, because this is something we can't demonstrate in a lab. So in some ways, we're trying to put a number to something that is scientifically impossible. Scientifically, we cannot do it at all. And so people will argue, well, he's using the wrong numbers there. It's like, I don't even know how you put a number to it. You could argue that the number would be way bigger than that. It's just, with our intelligence and all the knowledge we have, not that we're all knowing, but we can't make any progress in creating life. This one might be a little bit too hard for kids, but for me, it's just kind of interesting. So there must be a beginning. For us, you know, we say, well, God created everything. That's our beginning. And an atheist or an evolutionist might look at that and say, well, that's just faith. You know, well, where did God come from? They don't like that argument. That's one of the problems with the watchmaker argument. They'll say, well, you're just making it more complex, because where did the watchmaker come from? Well, if you go with that line of reading, you can't explain anything. Like, well, who left that door open? You could say, well, John. So, well, where did John come from? What? I don't have to explain that. You know, I can explain an intermediate step here. I don't need to know everything. So there must be a beginning. So that's our beginning. So in science, I had to teach about the Big Bang. The Big Bang, basically, scientists know that all the galaxies are moving away from each other. Okay, so things are expanding. And so basically, just Big Bang, they say, well, okay, if you take that back in time, things must have all been together. Now, this is crazy, and you're going to think I made this up. But basically, you have this whole wad of everything in the universe, all these billions of galaxies with billions of stars, billions of planets, and it's all squished into a space smaller than a dime. Okay, I love teaching this part in science, because I'm like, so does that make sense to you guys? And they'd all be like, No, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Go to the NASA website. That's what it says. That's how it explains the Big Bang. And it's a bunch of nothing squished into a space the size of a dime. Like, okay. But anyway, so nothing exploded, and it blew up all over the place. Okay, and then it spread out. Okay, so then eventually, if we have an eternity past, and everything exploded, eventually it goes out to the point of where it starts coming back together again. And then it all starts over. And then and nothing explodes again. Okay? But each time we're going to lose a little energy, right? And so each time it's not going to go quite as far as it did. And eventually it's going to go back to where it stops. Okay. Well, it hasn't stopped, and yet we've been here for an eternity. So if it hasn't stopped, that means at some point it started. Okay? If at some point it started, that means there must have been a beginning. If there was a beginning, there must have been a cause. So something caused that to blow up. Okay? If there's a cause implies a creator. There must have been something that caused that, or someone that caused that. And this is the one that's too heady, and I probably should have skipped it. But it's kind of interesting to think about, because really the evolutionist has the same problem. At some point, they have to go back to a cause that they can't explain. So we could go back and say, well, God did it, and yeah, I can't explain God. And they could say, well, the Big Bang did it, but they can't explain the Big Bang. So we both have an element of faith in what we believe. Okay, so we'll come back down to earth a little bit here again. Okay, how do we go from non-living to living? So we've all seen some kind of little chart like this, except with better looking monkeys, right? And so, you know, there's some little monkey walking on all fours, and then you have one kind of hunched over, looks like somebody with arthritis, and then you have a full-grown man with his tool. So he's really progressed, right? Okay, and in my belief system, I look at this and I say, I don't believe this. And I don't believe any of that, okay? But still, we look at that picture, and it maybe troubles us a little bit. We're like, oh, yeah, I mean, I can kind of see that. Okay, but let's go back a little further. So let's go back to here, and let's not go to like a cat or a mouse or something. Let's go clear back to the very simplest form of life. So a single-cell organism. So we have a very simple cell, a single cell organism. So life, if we take this back, we have to start with this. Okay, the catch is this single cell is incredibly complex. It has the ribosomes and the nucleoid and the plasma membrane. It has these different parts. It has like little tiny biological machines running around inside it and stuff. And even if you think about life, it has to be able to reproduce to be life, right? It has to be able to reproduce and to turn into anything else, certainly has to be able to reproduce. And that's a big deal. So even if a scientist could create life, creating something that has the mechanism that makes it able to reproduce is a big deal. That is not simple. So even a, quote, simple cell is not simple. Okay, so what came before that cell? I keep going the wrong way. I have a rock. It's a pretty rock, but it's a rock. Okay, so just there has to be something non-living over here. Something that's not breathing, something that doesn't reproduce, something that doesn't really have much going for it. And it's probably not a rock. They'd probably say, well, it's a collection of gases and water and pressure and a lightning bolt. And it's going to make this. Really? You got to be kidding me. You're saying that I can just take something that's not living and zap it somehow, mix it together somehow, and all of a sudden it's this living, breathing, functioning thing with little things moving around inside of it, and it's able to just split in two and reproduce itself? There's just no way. I mean, there has to be a creator involved in this process. There has got to be a creator. And our kids need to understand. And honestly, some of this is kind of easy to teach kids because you say, hey, guys, you know, here we are. And some people think that we came from monkeys. And the kids will be like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. They just intuitively, they know that that doesn't make any sense. So even just as you reinforce it a little bit, that'll help them a ton. And this is a really big deal. How do we go from non-life to life? You know, even for Kathleen and I, we lost a baby during delivery. And I remember thinking that of here I was holding this baby that had died. And a fully formed, fully functional baby. And it had everything it needed for life. And the only thing missing was life. And, you know, it's like, here, scientists, add life. They can't do it. And what are their attempts? Well, let's shock the body. Let's press on the body. Let's warm up the body. You know, it's really pretty feeble. Life is a complex thing. And even with all our science, we can't do what, through evolution, theoretically happened by accident. So this is a great argument. And then just to think about the diversity of life, and this is something for kids that's fun, just to think of all the different animals and to think that, okay, one of two things happened. Either just naturally all these things came about, or somehow a creator helped bring these things about, or just flat out brought these things about. So just thinking about different life forms. Peacock. You know, it's just, I mean, some things are just hard to explain through evolution. You know, you look at that bird and you just, like, wow. You know, like the watchmaker thing, it's like, there was an artist involved there. That's cool. Now, in evolution, they would say, well, they're really pretty, so they'll mate. And, well, naked mole rats mate. You know, I mean, all kinds of ugly creatures mate, and they do just fine. And somehow this one needed this to be able to attract a mate? I don't know, that just doesn't really make sense, but I look at it, it's like, wow, that's really cool. Kangaroo, I mean, you just, like, what an odd creature, you know? And to think that the same evolutionary process would produce this and then produce that, like, I don't know, that just seems really odd to me. Some of you heard me talk about this before. This is a sea slug, and this is really gonna make me sound stupid, because you're not going to believe what I say. But the sea slug, what he does is he eats the algae and stuff, and he steals the DNA from the algae, which I know is impossible and cannot be done. And you can't eat DNA and have it become your DNA, but that's exactly what he does. Somehow, he steals the DNA, puts it in his own body, and it makes him able to do photosynthesis. He doesn't have to eat anymore. He can just kind of hang out and suntan and get energy from the sun like a plant. Wow. That's crazy. Did that just happen? Is that an accident? Or is he designed that way? And this is the barrel eye fish. And he's kind of weird because these things up on top of his head are his eyeballs. His eyeballs look straight up. And these things that look like his eyes are actually his nostrils. And I don't know what his nostril is supposed to be. But just thinking through it evolutionarily, it's like, how's that happen? How do your nostrils move up to where your eyes should be? It's a deep sea fish. He's not even sneaking up on anybody and they're thinking something in his eyes when it's not. Or it's all dark. You know, what's the explanation for that? Or how do your eyeballs move up into your head, and then your head develops this clear covering so that you can see a jellyfish up above you? I don't know. And nature's just filled with examples like that. We have a bird, a bat, and a bee. Of course, a bird is a bird. A bat is a type of mammal, and a bee is an insect. And these things are not evolved from each other, according to evolution. And so what you have is you have this very complex mechanism of being able to fly, and theoretically they all evolved this on their own. Because they're not in the same family. One of them didn't learn to fly and then evolve into the other ones. They're three distinct groups. And flight itself is so weird because you have to grow a wing. And the wing's not really helpful until you can fly. And so theoretically you would have these little arms that would, I don't know, you start growing these weird arms and I don't know, they say, well, maybe they could use them to like catch animals. And now they have this wing and it's kind of helpful. I don't know, that doesn't seem all that helpful to me, but that's the theory. And all three of these have to come up with, and it's not helpful, not helpful, not helpful. And then they get bigger and bigger and bigger, bigger and bigger and bigger until finally they're useful and they develop these hollow bones and they're nice and light and now they can fly. Like, wow, I just don't see that happening. Woodpecker, just another cool creature, is very different from the others. It has a tongue that goes up its head and kind of wraps around its brain. It's like, okay, how's that happen through evolution? You know, it just seems like it screams, there's a designer, there's somebody that created these unique, wild, strange, amazing animals. And nature just screams that, and the diversity of life shows that. And you can even just take your kids to the zoo. You don't need to know a ton about this stuff. It's just common sense, and you can just show your kids the different kinds of animals, and they'll understand that there must be a really cool creator that came up with some of these things. Okay. You need to equip your kids with the basics of your belief system. So it's important that they know that there's a creator, but you need something more specific than that, because most of us would believe things that are more specific than that. So practically, the most important thing is that you would teach them how to get to heaven. Seems like if our faith is important to us, this would be the most important part of our faith. In fact, if there's anything you could teach your kids, if it's true that there's an afterlife, well, then this would be the absolute most important thing you could ever teach your kids. And so they need to know this. A couple of summers ago, I spent about 6 weeks just going out to the parks and the mall and just going up and talking to people and asking them if they had a few minutes. I would just go up and say, hey, I'm just going around, I'm asking people about their beliefs in God. Can I talk to you for a few minutes? And a lot of them would say yes. And so I talked to them, and I'd ask them two really hard questions. The first is, if you died today, how sure are you that you go to heaven? And the second one was, and if you died today and God said, why should I let you into heaven, what would you say? Or sometimes I'd rephrase that one as, what do you think God's requirements are to get into heaven? And it's amazing how few people could answer those questions in a way that showed that they had some kind of understanding or some kind of a specific belief system. Most people's belief systems were very fuzzy. A lot of the people I talked to were kids, high school kids, junior high kids who were hanging out at the park, skateboarding, nothing better to do in the summer. And I would talk to them and just over and over again, just fuzzy, fuzzy beliefs. And yet, we live in a society where most people would claim to believe in God. And most people would say, yes, it's really important that people know how to get to heaven. And most of those parents did not teach their kids this in a way that made sense, in a way that their kids remembered, in a way that their kids could say it clearly enough that they could explain something or even just have a good sense in their own mind of what they believed. And so this is the most important thing. You need to know this clearly, and then you need to teach that to your kids. And so what I saw was the adults didn't know it clearly, and so then it made sense because the kids I talked to didn't know it clearly. And so I had the opportunity to just talk to a lot of people about that. Teach them how to live the way God wants. Basically, in a religious system, there are a lot of different things that we teach. And one of the things that's going to be important is that we're not just giving our kids head knowledge, that it's not just, okay, well, you need to know this and you need to know this, but that somehow the things that they learn actually impact their life. And the Golden Rule is a great example. The Golden Rule, I think, exists in every major belief system in some form. So the golden rule is do to others what you would have them do to you, or in some religions it's stated in the negative. Like, you know, don't do evil unless you want others to do evil to you. So just everything. I mean, Muslim, Buddhism, Hinduism, the different forms of Christianity, we all have this concept, this golden rule. I think it's a great example, and I think it's very practical with our kids, that we take our kids and we teach them just basic truths like, you know, hey, don't hit your brother with a toy. You know, would you want somebody to hit you with a toy? Or we're sharing, you know, well, hey, if you were sitting there and you really wanted a toy and somebody else was playing with it for a long time, would you want them to share with you? Or would you want them to kind of hog it and be selfish with it? And we talk through these things with our kids all the time. Need to teach our kids the basic beliefs, or you could also put foundational beliefs. In this picture, you can see an example or an illustration of if here they have some kind of maybe refinery tanks or equipment where they're storing some kind of liquid, I guess maybe oil or gas or something. And obviously, they're building a foundation for one of these tanks. And you can imagine that tank is going to hold just tons and tons and tons of liquid. And so this foundation becomes really important. If this is not a nice thick bed of concrete, what's going to happen is all that weight is going to press down and it's going to crack this concrete. And if it's big enough crack, what will happen is then that will cause damage on the side and you could lose all of the liquid that you have. And so the foundation is really important. Well, the same thing in our belief system. We need to have a foundation and we need to teach it real clearly. And so this would be my question for you. What are the five most important things that you believe and want to pass on to your kids? So, a couple weeks ago, when we were looking at how to help your kids have good grades, we talked about how important it is to focus on what's important. And there was a picture of a lady that was standing in between, or in an aisle in a library. I mentioned how, you know, what if you just said, hey, I'm going to test you on everything on one of those shelves, one of those aisles of books. And you'd be like, I can't do that. That's too much. You know, you need to kind of know what's important. And so same thing with our kids, when we're trying to teach them about God, teach them about beliefs, it's sure helpful if you can say, well, hey, here are the five most important things. It doesn't have to be five, but you know, for me, there's four important things I want to pass on to my kids. And so it's important to be able to think through that, and then you can really focus on what's important and not focus on the minor things. You know, and I think it's really easy to get caught up into, you know, the little things that aren't as significant and maybe kind of bypass some of the things that are really big. Have them study and memorize passages of sacred writings. If you have a book or a set of books that's important to you, then by all means, have your kids learn that. Obviously, I believe in the Bible. I believe the Bible is God's message to us. It's His writing. It's His words. And if somebody really believes that, then boy, it seems like that's something I should pass on to my kids. I mean, if it's really truly the words of God, well, how important is that? And if you think about the time that we put into teaching different things to our kids, you know, we teach our kids math and social studies and reading and art and maybe music and sports, and how to cook, and how to do chores, how to mow the lawn, how to clean up the rooms, and we teach them about God. And you look at how much time we spend on each of those things. Well, it's pretty easy for people to send their kids off to school and academically for, let's say, 49 hours a week, or 35 hours a week, 7 hours times 5 days, and for 35 hours a week, they're being taught academics. How many hours are they being taught by the TV? Or how many hours are they being taught about God? How many hours are they studying these writings that we believe are important and are from God? Well, we need to really think through that and make sure that we balance what we're doing with our kids in a way that reflects what we value, what we think is important. Teach your kids to be able to defend and prove the basic beliefs. Another word for that is apologetics. I'm not a big fan of big words, so It's basically the same thing. So none of us want to be able to, none of us want to take our kids to church and to teach them our belief system and pass it on to them, and then they get 18 and they run off and they're involved in a whole bunch of wildness and things that we don't approve of. We don't want that, right? We want them to take the things that we teach them about faith and to get on to where they're older and they are still embracing the same things. Because we believe that what we're teaching is based in truth, and so we want our kids still following that same truth. And so our kids need to be able to understand the truth behind what we're teaching them. They need to be able to defend that. They need to be able to go into a college class and in college to have a professor stand up and say things, you know, like, well, science has disproven the Bible, or science has proved that there is no God, and they need to be able to sit there and process that and say, no, that's not right because of this and this and this. So that would be our goals. We're equipping our kids not just to believe something, but to be able to defend that belief. So it's not just a blind faith. Well, I believe this because my parents told me to believe it, but they understand that our faith is not blind, but it has a lot of reason to it. There might be steps of faith where we don't know everything, but it's not just a completely blind, well, I'm just going to believe this because this is what somebody taught me. And so just practically, we can help our kids think through the questions that people have, help them think through stuff like creation and evolution, help them think through the questions that they come up with. You know, kids will ask questions as they start to process who God is and what's important in life, and we need to be able to help them find answers that aren't just blow-off answers, but really help them to be able to understand faith and to be able to defend it and eventually prove it. And so, obviously, a 9-year-old is not going to be able to defend their faith. But when a kid is 14, 15 years old, they should be able to really be able to put some things together. And they should be able to think reasonably. They should be able to hear arguments that they've never heard of before and to be able to reason through them and come up with a defense of their faith. Because we've, through life, we've thought this is a very important topic, and so we've equipped them for that. And then the last thing is just to set a good example. And this goes for all areas of parenting. It's hard to really build into your kids a pattern of making their bed if you never make your bed. And that's why we don't make our kids make their bed. It's hard to say, well, it's really important to have a clean desk when your desk looks like mine. You know, you have to set an example in the things that are important to you. And so when it comes to faith, well, if you think it's really important to read religious material, then you need to be involved in reading. If you think it's important to know certain doctrines, then you need to know those doctrines. If you think it's important to know that there's a creator, you need to know that well enough to explain that to your kids. Now, there's a catch here in that studies have shown that when you're passing on your religion to your kids, the most important thing is the dad's example. Hands down. I mean, it's just, I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but what the wife does in terms of just pattern in your life and going to church and stuff like that is, I don't want to say it, but kind of insignificant compared to what the dad does. You know, dads, you really have to set an example, and you have to set the pace for your kids. And I think they look at dad as kind of a leader of the family, and they want to see what the leader thinks is important, and if it's something that's not important to him, then what the mom does is really downplayed. And so dads really have to set a good example. And that's really crucially important for them to be involved. So, of course, there's our contact information again. I think you should all have that. And we would love to talk to anybody with any questions you have. And, of course, you're welcome to church at any time. 10 o'clock Sunday mornings. And still going through that series called High Voltage, looking at some of the unique teachings of Jesus. Does anybody have any questions on any of that? Okay, yeah. So the question is, what do we teach our kids in terms of other religions' beliefs? And then the question of tolerance is tied into that too. And so basically, just as different religions come up, we'll teach them the specifics of the religion. Now, there are things that I don't agree with in different religions that I think sometimes it can be easy to kind of belittle other beliefs or to make fun of them. And trying to think of an example. Like, let's say the Mormons believe that the Garden of Eden was in Missouri, which is true. I mean, it's true that they believe that. Okay, but and that would be easy. I would say that to my kids. My kids would laugh. We would all be, you know. And that's not really right. So what I try to focus on is, well, what's the belief about how do you get eternal life? And that's the most important thing, that they understand that, because that's the crux. And so for me as a Christian, I believe that you get eternal life through faith in Jesus Christ. And other religions would all be some kind of form of working your way to heaven, somehow becoming good enough that God will accept you. And so I try to have that be the crux of the issue. And so we all believe crazy stuff. I mean, we believe it because we believe it's true. And so, for instance, I believe in the Trinity. I believe that God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit are all three separate, completely separate, distinct beings. And yet they're all one. That doesn't make any sense. The only reason I believe that is because that's what the Bible teaches. But it's a crazy belief, in a sense. And so I don't want to look at others and say, well, they have crazy beliefs. Well, I believe in the virgin birth. I believe that Jesus did miracles. I believe that Jesus told Peter to find a coin in the fish's mouth. And, you know, all kinds of weird things. It doesn't matter that's weird. It just matters if it's true. Tolerance is a tricky issue because the way the world kind of pushes tolerance right now is not just that we put up with other people and love them and respect their beliefs. But the world's pushing more for an embracing and an acceptance of other people's beliefs. And so with our kids, we want them to understand that something's true or not true. If someone's Muslim, you can still love them, and you should still love them. And you treat them with respect, and you don't make fun of their beliefs. But I believe that they're in error. And the loving thing to do would be to teach them, you know, some of the things that Jesus taught, to help them understand forgiveness. Or another big issue right now would be homosexuality. I would want my kids to love homosexuals. I have a fairly close friend. I don't know him super well, but I met him when I was in another country one time, and it turns out he's homosexual, and he's kind of a friend of mine. I care about him. He would say that I've been nice towards him, but I don't think what he's doing is right. And so, to me, that's tolerance. It's loving. He doesn't believe that what he's doing is right either. It just depends on how you define tolerance. And so, an appropriate level of tolerance would be, I love you, but I don't agree with you, and I don't embrace what you're doing. But I still love you. Obviously, it would be wrong to be like the, is that church in Texas? The church that goes and pickets people's funerals and, you know, it'll be a military funeral or something, and say, well, this is God's punishment on gays, even though the person that had died is not gay. It's like, well, that's just yucky. That's just hatred, and that would not be appropriate, in my opinion. So a really good speaker on tolerance is Josh McDowell, and he has some really good materials on that, and I think he does a really good job explaining that balance of being loving without embracing truths just for the sake of tolerance. So we want to love people, but there's still a right and wrong, and there's truth in different situations, and so we want to help them with that. Okay, so the question is, why did I put the creation part in as a significant level of developing faith in the kids? So my impression of talking to youth in this city is, you can go out and you can talk to any 7th and 8th grader kid, and they will have a respect for God. They will want to know what God thinks. They will care about his opinion on things, and they'll want to get right with God. or you can go out and you can speak to 100 seniors in high school, and they won't give a rip. They don't care. There's something that changes in those ages, and I think part of it is they start getting this idea of, well, wait a minute, we just came about here naturally, so how does God fit into this? How am I accountable? And nobody is teaching them the other side. So like for me, when I got to college and I heard that there was a reasonable explanation on how we could come about and that there were weaknesses to the theory of evolution, I walked out of that debate and I felt like I'd been lied to when I was younger. I just was like, whoa, I have never heard this stuff. And it was just, some of it was just simple stuff. I mean, the people that were speaking were a lot smarter than me, so it's, some of it would go over my head, but some of the stuff is just real simple and real intuitive, almost. And I had never heard any of it. What happens is parents see this as an issue that's too complicated and that's above their head, and so they just don't touch it. And so I guess what I'm saying is if you don't touch it, no one else is going to touch it. And so it's really going to undermine the faith of your kids. Unless they have to be in a good Sunday school or youth group or something that hits on this quite a bit. And that's going to be pretty rare too, I think. Okay, so the question is, if I had a 13-year-old kid that came up and said, Mom and Dad, I love you, but I believe the same things you do. I don't believe in Christianity anymore. How would we handle that? To me, it would be similar to if they came up to us and said, you know, I really don't think I need math anymore, and I've had enough of that, and I don't think it's important in life. And I'd be like, well, I don't care what you think, because I'm the dad, and I think it's important. And not to be heartless or something, there's just an element of, I'm the dad, I'm the one that's going to decide what's important, and so I'm going to help you through this process, and I'm going to keep teaching you, just like if it was in an academic area, because I think it's important. To me, you know, if they did that when they're 18, there's not a whole lot I can do about that. But when they're younger, I expect to still have input. And I mean, honestly, just in our family, it's really hard to fathom that because God is just such a part of who we are as a family, and it's kind of part of being Nelson. And so I would be pretty shocked if that happened. Yeah. And so I would want to work through that with him. You know, okay, like, what are your doubts? What are you worried about? Why do you believe something else? What do you believe? Even for some of the creation stuff. I know in our youth group, we had a kid that was kind of struggling with her beliefs and, well, I don't know that I want to believe this stuff anymore and kind of copping an attitude. But we had done some different creation videos and stuff, and she knew that we didn't evolve. Well, that's a starting point. It's like, okay, let's think through this. We didn't evolve, then where did we come from? Well, God. Okay, so you do believe there's a God. Well, yeah, I guess so. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, let's, you know, where do we go with this? Did this God communicate with us? Did he leave us any writings? Did he give us any instruction? You know, and help them try to pin down that belief. I think typically if a kid does that, there would be some kind of animosity towards their parents. And so I would really want to make sure that I watch the relationship. A great video on that is Cassie Bernal. She Said Yes is the name of the video. It's kind of hard to get. It's the story of the girl at Columbine that the Columbine killer said, do you believe in God or something like that? And she said yes, and then they shot her. But she had been a troubled teen and kind of gone through that and had turned her back on God. And the parents kept making her go to youth group, kept putting her in good situations, and she really turned her life around before she ended up getting killed. And so don't just assume that, well, if I really push this on them, it's going to be a big turnoff and they're going to hate me forever. It's like, I'll take that chance. I need to do everything I can to help you go down the right path. And so that would be the way we would play that. Any other questions? All right. Well, thanks for your time. Next week is the one on keeping your kids from gangs and the cartel. Again, you might not be concerned about that, but what you should be concerned about is at least keeping your kids from others who are a negative influence. And that'll be kind of the focus of the talk. So, and I think that's something that really starts from a really young age. So I encourage everybody to come to that if you can make it. So Thanks for your time.